Hello, welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, your weekly programme for teachers, policymakers and anyone with an interest in teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney and you can download podcasts of previous programmes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. This week I'm bringing you the second part of my interview with Dr. Gerry O'Connell from the Merino Institute of Education. Gerry O'Connell is an expert on religious education, especially at primary school level. In our conversation last week, we discussed matters such as the difference between teaching religion and religious education, the importance in education of starting with the students' experiences, social media as a force of oppression, and why contemplative space, depth of conversation, wonder, symbol, and story are central to religious education. In the second part of our interview, I began by noting that fewer Catholics attend church services on a weekly basis nowadays, and I asked Gerry O'Connell what the impact of that is on religious education in Catholic schools.
There's a lack of research in this area. It would appear to me anecdotally that it has increased the need to begin with the child in terms of teaching religious education, but that the lack of experience of liturgy has in some way left the children hungry for it. It is an interesting thing to me that David Hay was writing or was interviewed for a radio program in 2005, and he said that after all his research into the spirituality of children, he would have to conclude that while the dominant narrative that's out there is that if a child is born and is not given any kind of religious upbringing, they will grow up to be an atheist. And Hay said he reckons that it's the opposite that is the case. He thinks that children are naturally spiritual, naturally religious, and that it is the culture that drums that out of them, not the other way round. So I would find the church service thing is a particularly Irish phenomenon. That your religion and your religious affiliation in Ireland is all about Mass on Sunday as a Catholic. In other countries, Mass on Sunday is not taken as the dominant sign of being a Catholic Christian. And that we need, I suppose, to have some kind of humility or something around that. It's undoubtedly the case that the church scandals have resulted in that kind of church attendance, undoubtedly the case. But it's very interesting to me in Merino, our students go out on observations in some of our years into classrooms, and 5 to 6 times as many students see religious education now as saw 12 years ago before the scandals. So while there may be a diminishing in church attendance and that kind of stuff in Catholic schools, there seems to have been an increase in the actual teaching of religious education.
How important is prayer in religious education?
Absolutely vital in all of its forms. It's not just as simple as prayer. In 1995, the Alive-O programme came into Catholic schools, and an essential part of that was breathwork that's known now by the popular term mindfulness, in 1995. Since 1995, I have known that a simple test to find out what classrooms are teaching religious education is to walk into the classroom and say to the children, feel the floor with your feet, which was the beginning of such contemplative prayer. It has been going on now for 22 years. Did people do it in 1995? No. Did they do it in 2005? No. Round about 2012, it started to become a campaign in Ireland, let's bring mindfulness into schools. That was 17 years after it was brought in to 90% of the schools. But teachers didn't engage with it. They saw it as a waste of time. They don't now. It's as important now as it was then. I had a student in my class, in fourth class, 12 years ago, and her father met me a few years back now when she was doing Leaving Cert, and he said to me, I was taking her up for her Leaving Cert, her first Leaving Cert exam, and as we got to the door of the school, she turned around to me and she said, I really missed the breathing with Mr. O'Connell, because we would start every morning with it, and it was a beautiful start to the day for them. So it begins with that. Your older listeners will probably remember the kind of prayer advocated by Tony DeMello and how that contemplative approach was such a dominant part of it. And I believe that there is great need in schools for that now, not only in Catholic schools, but in schools generally. People talk about prayer. It has many forms and there are many ways, but it's about slowing things down. We all know that our grannies in the Catholic tradition, with 15 decades of the rosary a day, had great wisdom. And Goldman and the Dalai Lama, when they did the research on gamma wave activity in the brain, comparing illiterate Buddhist monks with Harvard grade A students, they found that the illiterate Buddhist monks had higher levels of gamma wave activity. So is prayer important? You betcha.
Why do you say it's more necessary today than ever before?
Because children are under assault the whole time. They don't get space. They don't play outside. It's too dangerous, or there's a health and safety gig the whole time or whatever. You have very little space for them in their lives. There used to be space for children if they went to church once a week. They got this quiet time. That's gone. There used to be space for children when they went outside to play. That's gone. Everything is controlled and organized and presented. So if you can take a moment in the day, which, as William Blake said, a moment in the day that Satan cannot find. And he wasn't talking about Satan in any kind of a mythology. He was talking about the strategic mind getting in the way of this spaciousness that every thinking human life requires, a timeout.
If you don't define a Catholic in particular by their attendance at church services, how do you define a Catholic or a practicing Catholic?
You define a Catholic very simply from the meaning of the word. Universal, welcoming all. Dermot Lane, a parish priest in Dublin, one of the world's foremost theologians, but don't tell anyone in Ireland, whose first book, The Reality of Jesus, has just moved over 100,000 copies and been published in China. Dermot Lane talks about the importance in Catholic schools of retaining, remembering the liberating memory of Jesus of Nazareth, and that it is a subversive and inclusive and disturbing memory, and that it is something that a Catholic is defined not by their attendance at church. Sure, every time that Jesus went to the temple, he got in trouble, but by their action in the world. And that in some way, I have said before, I know I've been quoted as saying this, every primary school in Ireland wants the children to be the best that they can be. Every Catholic primary school in Ireland wants the children to be the best that they can be for others. And to be Catholic is to make sure that the other has priority over me. And that is first and foremost, not church attendance.
That's hard.
It is about laying down your life for others, if you like. It's about making bits of yourself. It's about encouraging the children to do that. If you do that, you remember Oscar Romero when he said, "I open up the doors of my house to the poor, and they call me a saint. I tell others to open up the doors of their houses to the poor, and they call me something entirely different." There's something there about the prophetic nature of the Catholic, of someone who understands what that is about. That is a danger to the dominant narrative in Ireland today, that everything can be saved by having enough wealth. And we have record numbers of homeless people. We've record numbers of children going to school hungry. And we have record numbers of millionaires. And how does that happen all at once? Who will ever call that to task? Because you will notice that any time that a church person, for example, begins to make noise in a forum, they'll find yet another reason to stop that conversation. I feel very strongly about that there's something there, there's a lack of For me, it comes back to the economic crash. We had a choice. We could have used that as an opportunity for the poor, but we used it as an opportunity to save the rich. And I include ourselves in that. That's to our eternal shame. We will have to tell our great-grandchildren what we did. There always was a pope speaking out on behalf of the poor. And the pope that is in Rome at the minute, he is Francis of Assisi. He is not any of the other Francis figures in the church. And he speaks out constantly about the poor, but nobody hears it.
But what people say is, isn't it easy for him? Because he is surrounded by the wealth of the Vatican and he doesn't have a mortgage to pay. He doesn't have children to put through education and things like that. So doesn't that undermine his authority in saying those things?
I wish he'd have an auction in the Vatican Museum and get a lot of the junk out of there, all right, you know. But that's not my place. I think that that's a conversation that's way beyond where I'm at, you know. And I suppose in some way it constantly gets away and needs to be drawn back. That when we say something like to be for others, we mean the people sitting with us around the table. We're not talking big picture. It starts local and moves out from there. And only the ramblings of an old man like this has it moving out into areas where I shouldn't even be commenting.
It's just something that's so difficult today and so radical in terms of the messages we're getting everywhere else in society.
Absolutely it is, without a doubt. And I have great hope for young people. I have great faith in teachers and I have great hope for young people as a result. As I've said already, we're constantly attracting the brightest and the best into teaching and they're doing great work in very difficult situations. And one of the things that happened with the economic downturn that time when the pupil-teacher ratio was kicked again, I couldn't believe that. One of the things about religious education and religion in schools, as you know, is that it's an infringement of human rights. I think it's much more an infringement of human rights to have children in large class sizes. But that doesn't seem to be an issue. That has always been my issue. If you want to make connections with children, which is the most vital part of education, they need to be in small groups. We know that. Nothing happens in large groups. Little children in large classes, they're not anybody. They're lost. I want to say, by the way, because you mentioned about children and religious education in school. A friend of mine went to collect a child with special needs for learning support during an ORE lesson a while back. And when she got to the door of the classroom, the child who was on the ASD spectrum turned around to her and said, "Will you wait a minute? I want to hear about Jesus." And I just thought it was a lovely image of a child hungry to hear the story that all of their ancestors knew. And we assume that children know the stories, but we see our students coming into Marino and they don't know the stories. And not only do they not know the stories from scripture, if they're Catholic or whatever, they don't know the stories from the mythologies. We've lost a lot of that image work, if you like, that fed our religious imaginations, and that it would appear that one of the benefits of this happening in school is that children are actually being exposed to story and all of the imagination work that goes on with that.
That's one of the benefits of religious education in schools.
I think it is, yeah. I think that, I know that the poet David White talks about going across the fields as a child to Sunday school because every time you were able to tell one of the stories from the Old Testament, they'd give you a sticker. And he wanted to fill the book with all the stickers that he had. And he said that it fed his religious imagination. If you listen to White's poetry at any stage, you'll see it absolutely on fire with religious imagery from the stories that he had as a child. My own religious imagination was fed by a book called Heroes of the Bible that I got when I was 6 from an aunt in New York. I still have it. I had it in all the classrooms that I taught in school. The children like myself wouldn't read the stories that much, but they'd look at the pictures, at the images, because they were fabulous and they would just fire you up. I think that's an important part of things.
How well can religious education be integrated with other school subjects?
Integration is always going to be an issue. if teachers are differentiating for children who are not taking part in religious education. That's the first thing. If you have a school where every child in the school is of the same religion, then that doesn't arise. It becomes an entirely different thing, and there are all kinds of places that it can be integrated. An awful lot more happens, I think, in religious education than people imagine. The arts, for example, are all used in religious education. There is strongly an aesthetic approach in place because, as Maria Harris would have said, religious education is concerned with unspeakable mystery. She maintained that that was only accessible through the medium of the arts. That has been taken seriously by the writers of religious education programs in Ireland, but not every teacher understands why. In regard to other subject areas, during Maths Week in Marino here, we've always had a reading from the Book of Numbers, so it has tended to be a little bit trite in that regard. I know that the animals went in two by two and all this kind of stuff gets done. But, you know, it's not integration if it's contrived and just silly like that. I do believe, however, that story is such an essential part of it. Poetry, song, the visual arts, drama, lots of areas like that. It can be messy if people begin to confuse theology and history. So I don't advocate going down that road. And I've often seen in history people telling stories of Bible figures as if they're history. And they have never been.
And apart from integration, the broader picture of teaching religious education when you have children from different religions and none, how do teachers manage that in a religious school in particular?
Yeah, that's the question, I suppose, that we began with earlier on. It's a question of differentiation. And as of this moment, what happens in some schools in Ireland is that you have parents who want their children not to be exposed to other religions, let's say, in an Educate Together school, or don't want their children taking part in religious education in a Catholic school. So they go to the principal's office in some schools, which is, I think, a shocking image. The other thing that you see is that the children sit in the room and read. I have no issue with that. The more reading, I would believe that children probably don't get enough opportunity for that. For myself, I would advocate, particularly if it's a small group of children in the room who don't do religious education, that the teacher every week would choose some kind of a picture book with a moral story in it, and that those children would work with this and present it to the class on the Friday, so that there would be some kind of purposeful work in the area of morality or spirituality going on at the same time. You can't teach two lessons at once, but you can facilitate it.
If we move on to your own current work, Gerry, how do teachers learn, or prospective teachers, how do they learn to teach religious education?
I'm tempted again to be trite and say just like other subjects, but that's not really the case. My doctoral research was concerned with the perceptions of my past students about my practice here in Marino in regard to religious education. Probably the most important finding from that research was that what I didn't do appears to have been more important than what I did. The students, above all, valued the space that the course provided and the different things that I would do in religious education impacted on them, not only as teachers of religious education, but as teachers generally. Some of them insisted that it provided a huge element of professional development. I do remember one particular participant at one stage saying, for example, that I knew you didn't go into a classroom and shout at children. We all knew that. We didn't need to be told that in professional development. But we didn't know it was okay to go into a classroom and be quiet. And they found that kind of stuff really valuable. For myself, when I came to Marino here, I found my own way to teach it. I found it based on my own convictions, I suppose, based on my experience of being in adult groups, learning in the areas of, I suppose, religious education broadly, in the Mount Oliver Institute outside Dundalk, and in a variety of other places. But primarily my teaching of religious education here was fired by my experience of teaching it in primary school for 25 years. So I wanted my students to offer the children in school the opportunity that I had been able to offer the children that I taught. I eventually realized that I had seven elements in religious education here, and they don't necessarily come in a particular order. The first one was waiting and wondering. My sessions always begin with silence. I welcome the latecomers because I know they take a risk to arrive late. And so many of them, when they've gone on to teach in disadvantaged areas of the city, take that practice into the classroom. They know that the children come in late, it's not their own fault. So they make a fuss of them when they come in. They tell them how much they would have missed them if they weren't there. And they learn that in religious education in college, at least the ones I've spoken to told me that that's what they learned. Another element is the threshold experience. And this is because students are coming to religious education in college here on a busy day. They're coming from maths, they're coming from PE, they're coming from music, wherever, and that you have to do something to change the context. And the threshold experience would be an example of that. It might be mindfulness, or it might be a YouTube clip, or it might be a story, it might be a meditation, it might be a poem. The third element is asking the question. I ask lots of questions and I don't answer any, and it irritates the students like nobody's business, and yet they all do it in school. And when they ask me, what do you do if a child asks you a question you can't answer? I say, you tell them that that's a really good question. And you write it down and you put it up on the wall or put it in the really good questions box. They don't want you to answer their questions. If they've got a really good question, they want you to treasure it. And it's like Rilke said, they want you to live it. So we try to live the questions. Another element is gathering around the subject. And again, this is beginning with the student's experience and my experience, and that we share our experiences of things. It's very important in teacher education, and we are so blessed in Marino with small groups that we can do that. Journaling is an important part of it, and it's guided generally by three questions about the day's work. What did I learn? What does it say to where I am? And what am I going to do about it? And that those questions are aimed not at the student's head knowledge, epistemological knowledge, if you like, but at their ontological knowledge. They're aimed at their emotion. What was the feeling nature of the session? Another element is pushing back the horizon. New knowledge always does that. It pushes back the horizon. But the challenge for the students is always to remember that when you push back the horizon, you've opened up a whole vista to right and to left, as well as straight ahead. So they have places to go to learn more. And we always conclude the session with a ritual. So I've been known to dance, for example, with the students, which is a really strange thing for a musical illiterate, to be teaching students to dance or to be teaching adults to dance. But dance always changes things. The elements of my practice are hugely extra-rational, and I believe they are in keeping with an aesthetic approach where we seek to work in areas that cannot be easily explained or assessed.
You've said that sometimes what you did not do was as powerful as what you did. Well, what did you not do?
I never told them how to teach religious education. I suppose that was the primary thing, because the introduction to the book, like the manual for the washing machine, tells you what to do. But you needed a sense of, this is worth doing. You needed an experience of the subject. You don't teach students how to teach mathematics, but you'd like them to understand that thinking mathematically is very important. So you focus on that. And if they get that, they'll get the rest. And again, that's not my area, Sean. That would be yours. There has to be something there with the brightness of our students, that we trust them to do the learning that they need to do in regard to that kind of mundane stuff.
How important is it for a teacher to have religious faith themselves when teaching religious education?
The answer depends on how you define faith. If faith involves devotion rather than discipleship, for example, then the answer is not at all. If it involves fundamentalism rather than liberation, then the answer is not at all. If it doesn't serve the needs of the child, then the answer is not at all. If it gets in the way of the child's flourishing, then the answer is not at all. If, on the other hand, it involves an utterly ethical existence where the other has priority over me, then that faith is an absolutely vital gift to the teaching of religious education. It's very interesting to me, you know, that Brenda Watson wrote a book called The Effective Teaching of Religious Education. Now, it was based in the English context. In the first edition of this book, she travelled around England and Wales because Scotland is different. And she got into classrooms and she watched teachers teaching religious education. Now, it may have been at second level mostly, but she watched teachers teaching religious education, and then she surveyed the teachers and she asked them what was most important characteristic about being a good religious education teacher. And there were 11 things. And one of those 11 things was have a strong religious faith. Okay. But Brenda then concluded that piece of the book by saying that the best religious education teacher that she saw on all her journeys was an atheist. And the reason why she was the best religious education teacher that she had seen was because she wasn't letting her own convictions get in the way of the children's religious education. That can be an issue for people if their own convictions are getting in the way. To be able to facilitate children in religious education, who knows who has faith? I know that young people now will tell you they don't have faith. But you know, there are signs of faith that go way beyond devotion into a serious discipleship, making bits of themselves for others. And those are very important things.
That was Gerry O'Connell speaking about his faith in teachers, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. To download over 300 Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from all good online bookshops and libraries. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.